Thank you.
Welcome to another Robotics Institute seminar. This week, it's our great privilege to welcome back the fold Todd Yocum. Todd was a robotics PhD student here many years ago. I guess you're going to talk a little bit about this. Maybe I'll just fill you in on the most recent history is, I'm sure most of you have heard this, but maybe some of you haven't. So there's a lot of excitement going on in Pittsburgh right now about the growth of the robotics industry, and probably the biggest thing that's happened in the last few years was Foster Miller coming to Pittsburgh. And what brought Foster Miller to Pittsburgh was the acquisition of Applied Perception, Todd's company, and Hagen Schemps and
Automatica.
Automatica. So that was last year. I forget how much the newspaper published, how much money they paid for this. There was some range there. I guess there's some contingencies, which I don't suppose we're ever going to hear all the little details on this. But a very exciting event in the development of commercial robotics. So, you know, this is our opportunity to get all the gory details for Todd about how that worked. Now, the other thing I might just mention is, I don't know if, are you going to talk about No Hands Across America?
I'll talk a little bit about that, yeah.
Yeah, so I just thought, you know, it's very fitting that that he's here now, because right now another really exciting thing that's going on is a kind of rebirth of automation in passenger vehicles. And right when Todd left was right at the height of our previous research in that area. So anyway, join me in welcoming Todd back, and take away.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Matt. And I have to say, when I was a grad student, I never thought I would be up here giving an RI seminar, because they had all these distinguished people talking about technology with fancy equations and cool graphs up there. So I'm truly honored that Matt invited me to come back, and I'm happy to be here to talk to you guys today about three things. My time here in Pittsburgh, while I was here at CMU, and then what I've done since I've left CMU, the kind of robotics stuff that we're doing at Applied Perception. I'm going to throw in a little bit of a job talk, come work for us. I don't know if that's legal or not, but I'm going to do it anyway. And then finally, just give you five or six things that kind of came to my mind as I was putting this together that sort of, I don't know, I think maybe could help you as you guys all decide where you're going to go with your lives after you leave CMU. So I put together one slide that encapsulated my life here. Actually, it's my whole life. 40 years old, I just celebrated my 40th birthday. I was born in a small town, southern Indiana, 5,000 people. Claim to fame, they shot the movie League of Their Own there, so for those a little bit older, Madonna was there, which was very cool. I went to Indiana State University, and anyone here under 25, what is Indiana University's claim to fame? Raise your hand. Anyone here from Boston?
Larry Bird.
Larry Bird, very good. Larry Bird went to Indiana State. I went there, played football for 4 years. About when I was a sophomore, I kind of realized, yeah, you're not going to be a pro football player. You need to work on the school side of things. So I did, and tell a story about Takeo and why I'm here. I applied to grad schools, Florida, Michigan, and CMU's ECE department. I was 21 years old, sitting in my dorm room. I get a phone call on my dorm phone. Yeah, hi, this is, actually I didn't. Takeo left a message with my roommate, and he could not quite get your name correct, so I had to call this guy, 412-268, whatever. So I called, hi, this is Todd, hi, this is Takeo Kanati. Bear in mind, I have no idea who he is, all right? He says, you know, I'm on the ECE admissions committee, and I noticed that you wrote in your interest that you're interested in computer vision and robotics. Literally, that was it. I was interested in computer vision and robotics. He said, by the way, we're starting a robotics department here, and I thought it might be, you know, better for you if you came to robotics. And I said, oh, okay, well, let me think about that. At this point, I'm engaged, all right? We're getting married this fall. I said, let me think about that. He says, sure. Well, I need to know by tomorrow morning because I'm leaving for Japan. So, frantically, you know, you call your parents, call your friends, you ask them, you call up your fiance, honey, great opportunity. How would you like to move to Pittsburgh? And in the late 80s, in 1990, Pittsburgh had this image of smokestacks and steel town, and frankly, not a lot going on. When the other options are Florida, which his son and her sister is there, and Michigan, where we had friends there. But needless to say, we decided to come here, thanks to Takeo. Very appreciative of that. I got here fall of 90, and essentially when I arrived, never heard of email, all right? There was no, like cell phones were new then, never heard of email, never used email, never written a line of not just C, Pascal code, C code, any kind of high-level language code whatsoever. So I come to CMU from Indiana State. I'm in my office. I've got some, I don't even know her name, some girl from MIT is next to me. It's like, okay, great. Then I have someone from Stanford right next to them, and I'm thinking, okay, they're doing this stuff, and I'm saying, how do I find out what the directory structure is here? What LS, Todd? It's LS. Hit LS. So the fortunate thing was I was a fast learner. And I hooked up with Chuck Thorpe, who at that point was, I guess he had just become a faculty member at Takeo, just a brand new faculty member, and began working on the NavLab project. And the first thing that he had me do was write A-star code and learn how to use X. Now, you guys, do you still use X? Is X still used?
Down there somewhere.
Wow, they're just looking at me like, what's he doing? Okay. So began working with Chuck on the NavLab project, and we were able to do some pretty cool stuff. I've kind of interspersed some videos throughout here and tried to make them not longer than a minute or two, but just wanted to try and show them. Uh-oh. There we go. State-of-the-art video for 1990. Sound. How do I get sound?
Plug it in.
Yeah. All right, I'm failing my audiovisual qual. Any of you smart guys in the back know how to do this? This right?
That looks right to me. And then hit volume up on your laptop. So at least are you seeing a volume meter on there?
No.
Okay, well, that's perfect.
I have it in the, which jack do I have it in?
Do you have it in the mic one?
Oh, I
have it in headphones.
Headphone, yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to see that.
All right, well, I'll narrate.
Okay.
Let's try this again. So in 1990, we had the NavLab 1, which is this blue van you're going to see here in a minute.
Suppose I need to deliver
and Chuck will talk to you.
Supply of cold drinks to my friend Keith, who lives a half mile away, but I'm too busy to drive over. Fortunately, I have a 1990 model NavLab computer-controlled van sitting out front. It is equipped with all the standard goodies. Television cameras to see the road, a scanning laser rangefinder that measures 3D positions, computers to digitize and process the images,
Dean Parmelo,
and computer-controlled steering and speed. The NavLab has software for image interpretation, including specialized modules for following dirt roads, traveling through intersections, and driving on main roads. I toss in the case of drinks, fire it
Chuck
up,
Thorpe.
And tell it how to drive.
Is Leland here?
To Keith's house.
No.
The 1990 model NavLab does not come standard with route planning software, so I have to look over the map stored in the NavLab's computer and generate specific instructions on where to go and how to drive. The NavLab built the map earlier by watching as I drove it around the neighborhood, recording the locations of roads, the shapes of intersections, and the locations of 3D objects. I add a few annotations to the map to tell the nav lab what processing modules to use, where to speed up, when to slow down, and where to stop. I hit the run switch, step out of the nav lab, and it takes off. The nav lab has several different ways of seeing roads and needs hints from the map to know which method to use at which location. I told it to drive along the streets using images from the color cameras processed by a fast neural network algorithm, which we call Alvin. It digitizes images from a color camera and processes them to enhance the contrast between road and off-road. The enhanced images are fed to a simulated neural network, which has been trained by watching a human drive along similar roads. Alvin's neural network directly outputs steering angles to the NavLab steering wheel. Suddenly, an unexpected obstacle appears in front of the van.
P.I.'s kid. This was before the days of human use review panels.
And when a vertical object is detected in front of the van, an emergency stop command is sent directly to the low-level controller. The van halts, waits for the obstacle to disappear, then resumes driving along its route. When the nav lab approaches intersections, the color cameras see only asphalt, and Alvin is unable to interpret the images. The map gives instructions to switch to landmark navigation. The laser rangefinder finds 3D objects on the side of the road that it has previously recorded in the map, and uses those objects as landmarks to update its position on the map. Once the nav lab knows exactly where it is, it can drive blind using its inertial guidance system long enough to traverse or accurately turn through an intersection. Leaving the intersection, the nav lab's map tells it to pay attention to its color cameras again and to increase its speed. Alvin finds the road again and steers the nav lab toward its goal. Finally, the nav lab uses dead reckoning to predict that it should be approaching Keith's house, uses 3D sensing to find his mailbox, and comes to a stop. The drinks are still cold.
How many in here had seen that video, just so I know? Okay, that's good, not too many. Now, the next video is one that I shot when I was a grad student, and this is what my advisors have had me do. So if any of you ever think your advisors are tough, this is what they make first and second year grad students do back in the good old days. The setting here is what we call the slag heap. This is now like a luxury house area in Shadyside. This is me on a hill in a rainstorm while the PI is in the van as it's driving, as Alvin's driving. The key thing here that I think is cool is that, as you'll see, the water goes completely over the vehicle. It just keeps on driving straight through the, straight through the puddle and keep on going. This was some of the first work that we did here that actually Dean Pomerleau did, and it was sort of seminal work in AI research applied to computer vision called Alvin, a neural network system. Here I am in the water puddle, filming Dean in the dry, driving through the puddle again. As you can see, I don't know if you notice, there were two Honda generators strapped on the back of this vehicle to supply power to all the computing. And essentially, the technology on there is equivalent now to what you can buy for like $3,000 on kind of semi-luxury cars, adaptive cruise control, lane departure warning type thing. So it's amazing how far we've come. All right, moving on a little bit, essentially I just spent a lot of time thinking, figuring out how the heck am I going to get out of here? What am I going to do, surrounded by these academic giants, to earn a degree and get out of here? One thing that we did was we built a vehicle that drove itself, steered itself from Washington, D.C. through Pittsburgh to San Diego, California, essentially 98% of the way. It's a 2,850-mile trip, and all but 50 miles, the vehicle did the driving while Dean and myself were behind the wheel, sort of monitoring for safety. And that event was sort of a seminal moment in sort of my business career in that we thought, you know, people might want this. This might be a good technology. And at that point, we thought, oh, yeah, all cars will be self-driving. But it sort of got us thinking on that route and said, well, what else could we use this for? And one of the things we could use it for was not to turn the steering wheel, but to watch how I'm driving, or you're driving, or more importantly, a truck driver's driving at night when he hasn't slept in 10 hours, and provide them feedback about when they're going to drift out of their lane. And in large part because of that, Dean and I have founded AssistWare Technology to start going down the path of commercializing that. And this was in 95, when we were both still here at CMU. Two other important things happened that year. For better or worse, after this No Hands Across America, the Wall Street Journal said that Pittsburgh was Roboburg. So we got this nomenclature of Pittsburgh's the place to go for robotics. The other thing that happened was that a lot of the foundations in the area, lots of foundations here in Pittsburgh, lots of very wealthy foundations, decided robotics is going to be an important thing in the future of the city. It's going to be our rebirth out of steel and whatever else was here. And they helped fund the Pittsburgh Robotics Initiative, which is essentially a group of people interested in forming robotics-related companies and nurturing them and figuring out what resources we needed to make those companies grow. And that was a pretty big moment. Skipping back to the technology side, once we drove across the country just using steering, we said, well, what else can we do? And we said, well, let's start thinking about completely automating the car. And not only automating cars, but also automating 40-foot transit buses, steering, throttle, brake, user interface, everything. And just for kicks, let's put them all on one road and have them pass each other and swerve around obstacles and talk to each other. And let's do a demo for the U.S. Secretary of Transportation. This is a very important guy. And not only do a demo for him, let's put him in the car with 30 other people so he can experience it firsthand. So between 96 and 97, John Kozar, myself, Dean Pomerleau, Bala Kumar, Mei Chan, and others worked really hard to put together a complete self-driving car package that we demonstrated to Secretary of Transportation Rodney Slater in San Diego in August of that year. We did 12,000 fully autonomous miles, gave about 2,000 people rides in self-driving cars over the course of about a 10-day period. And as I'll talk about in a minute, that was a very good thing, but a very bad thing. Real quickly, I just want to show you some of the technology and how things have progressed from 1990 to 1997. And you'll notice a theme of the videos here, too.
Suppose I need to rush some urgently needed supplies across town at rush hour.
They wouldn't let us say beverages anymore.
Fortunately, I have a 1997-mile Navlon 6 computer-controlled car. I hop in, fire up the engine, and it automatically starts its computers and sensors. The Navlon 6 comes equipped with a variety of sensors to see the road, traffic, and obstacles around it. It has a radar buried in the front bumper, a miniature TV camera mounted behind the rearview mirror, a GPS satellite positioning antenna on the roof, a LiDAR to look for traffic behind and in adjacent lanes, and sensors for vehicle speed and heading. I check the built-in touch screen to make sure the system is functioning and start the journey. As I drive along, I turn on the intelligent cruise control and the Navlon 6 keeps...
This is on 279 North.
...automatically. The computer systems are constantly watching the road and its surroundings. Ralph, the vision system, tracks the road by looking for lane markings and any other features which are high contrast and parallel to the road, such as shoulder edges or pavement joints. Ralph has already driven over 40,000 autonomous miles, including across...
This is a vehicle went across the country.
...San Diego, California. The radar on the NavLab is an advanced model. Unlike most automotive radars, which only measure range to other vehicles, this radar can also measure relative speed and bearing. When the computer puts together the road location from Ralph with the target locations from the radar, it can determine if another vehicle is in its own lane, the next lane, or on the shoulder, even when the road is curving. As I drive along, I start to get drowsy from a long day at work. I begin to nod off and start to steer off the road.
So it senses when I hit the boundary.
It sees what I'm doing, sounds an alarm, and nudges the wheel back in the right direction. When I hit the interstate, I switch the NavLab into autonomous mode.
Automated control on.
Now I can relax and catch up on my email while the NavLab handles all the driving. It is constantly monitoring the position of other vehicles around me and keeping an internal model of what they might do and how it needs to maneuver for safe, defensive driving. When a manually driven vehicle comes up quickly, my car sends an alert, checks for open space, and changes lanes to let the tailgater by.
It could actually do that by itself, then show it.
It should be. Its father is an active duty Army scout, the NavLab 2. The NavLab 2 spends its days driving cross-country using the same kinds of positioning, 3D sensing, and obstacle detection to find its way along rough terrain and dirt roads. Grandfather was the NavLab 1, built in 1986, which even in its prime had to lug around $1 million of equipment.
Chuck Thorpe.
Only move at walking speeds.
Marshall.
Now the younger generation runs everything on standard PCs buried in the trunk and powered through the cigarette lighter and has a top speed well in excess of the national speed limit. As we travel, the NavLab 6 detects other smart cars and buses. Since those vehicles drive more predictably and communicate with each other by radio, the NavLab can close up the gaps with those vehicles. Squeezing the vehicles together more tightly has really opened up the highways, and there is much less congestion than there used to be, and much less pollution due to idling and stop traffic, all without building more lanes. I can count on getting where I need to go and getting there on time. As the NavLab drives around a curve, its radar sees an obstacle, and the vision system correctly detects that the obstacle is in its own lane. The vehicle checks its vision system to see where the next lane is, checks its side and rear sensors to make sure the lane is clear, and slides over to change lanes. It also radios a warning to following automated vehicles so they can make a safe maneuver before they even see the obstacle. I get to my exit, the NavLab signals me, and I take back control and pull up the freeway. I'm relaxed, rested, and above all, safe. And I'm just in time for the party.
So, the thing that strikes me even now looking at it is everything you saw was real. And Bala was in these cars and John was driving these cars. They literally drove completely by themselves. And from the outside, it's like, well, this just looks like a car driving. It looked that realistic. And as I said, that was both a good thing from a technology perspective. It helped me graduate. And a bad thing because the DOT saw that and said, well, what are we paying you guys to do research for? And canceled the program. That's okay. What that did for Dean and I in the next year and a half or so, we said, all right, well, this funding's gone. What are we going to do next? How are we going to move this technology forward? So what we did was we essentially took everything in the back trunk running on a Pentium Pro and condensed it down to run on a PC-104 stack. You guys know what that is, okay. And built a little user interface by cannibalizing a radar detector. And sort of showing people this in the community and saying, you know, in the automotive community, is this something you guys want? Is this something that you can sell? And they said, yeah. Basically said, yeah, this is something we want. They bought a few. And that was sort of enough for Dean and I to say, okay, you know, this is our chance. We both had only one kid. The risk was only going to go up if we stayed longer. So we decided to leave CMU with a year of funding to try and commercialize this technology for vision-based lane departure and drowsy driver warning. Just as we left, the internet boom hits. So Dean and I are here in our 300 square foot office, no employees, not making much money, seeing people get paid billions and billions for clicking on a mouse, thinking. First we thought, man, we should apply to CS. that was, you know, just a little side comment. That was hard when you see, you know, people you know, your contemporaries doing this, and you're just kind of struggling out there, but you just got to fight through that sort of thing, and we did. During that time, we actually took what was in this and a PC-104 box, condensed it all to fit on one credit card-sized PC board. So real-time, really 60 hertz vision processing on a 60 megahertz Shark processor, including all the interfaces to the vehicle, for the haptic user interface to the driver, and took what you may have heard would cost $1 million, and those boards were under $500, and we thought, all right, we've got something here now. Now that was good. That was very good for the technology. But what also happened was at that point, we stopped doing technology and started doing marketing and business development, stuff like that. And at that point, that was sort of boring for me. I didn't really like doing that. So Dean and I both wanted to continue doing technology. We had an opportunity to work with some colleagues of ours that we knew from CMU at SAIC on a DARPA program called Perceptor. Perceptor is basically the next generation of all the off-road unmanned ground vehicle programs, and they needed, and we were lucky, they needed a non-traditional small business sub so they wouldn't have to pay cost share. And we happened to be from CMU, and we happened to know something about this. They put us on their team. We won, and essentially that started Applied Perception. That was the program that got us started. One thing that happened that year that, you know, has I think reflected our society for the past 6 or 7 years is 9/11 happened. And when that happened, tons of money and interest went into military robotics. And, you know, Applied Perception essentially has been fortunate since then to try and, or to have ridden that wave, but also try and do things that, you know, are, keep our guys out of harm's way and do good stuff for them. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit as well. Another thing that happened, which may seem like a really small thing, but was really cool, was we moved to a bigger office. And we had our first employee, Mark Ollis, another CMU grad, was our first employee. So we had three people now. And it's funny, when you're out on your own and you're kind of controlling everything, you know, you figure, oh, you know, everyone in here is a type A person, right? So, of course, you can do anything you want. It'll always be successful. But now, all of a sudden, you're responsible for somebody else and somebody else's family. And that, I think, really took some kind of, changed our mental model of how we're going to approach this business. And in some respects, that helped us flourish. Because beginning of that time, API and AssistWorks kind of took off, but both in different directions, which is a good thing. On the API side, we hit $1 million in revenue in 2002, which, at least for me, was a big number. That was like seven digits, right? I never saw seven digits anywhere. Seven digits. We also won the robotic patient recovery SBIR. SBIR is a defense or a government small business innovative research program. And that program essentially was our leapfrog into going whole hog into providing software. Applied Perception does software for unmanned ground vehicles. The RPR project, and I think I have this in here, essentially was to develop a robot pair, a very large car-sized robot, 6,000 pounds, and a smaller marsupial robot that sits in its back to aid battlefield medics in finding, treating, extracting, and then evacuating soldiers from the battlefield. Concept of operations, and this is very way out there. This is not happening anytime soon. But the concept was medic uses a handheld OCU to call the robot pair out to the battlefield. It comes out. The larger vehicle stays at a safe location, drops its ramp, and a smaller vehicle comes rolling out automatically to the medic. The medic can say, okay, grab this guy, drag him back in a stretcher. It can say, do a search path between these GPS locations. Or it can just say, stand where you are and wait till I call. If something was found, they'd be taken back to the larger vehicle, and the larger vehicle had two LSTAT litters built into it. And it looks very cool, because you could put a patient on each side of it. And let's see if I can stop this. Go back. Put a patient on each side of the vehicle, and they could be sent back to a casualty collection point automatically. And the reason that's important is because what our enemies do is they'll shoot you, but they're not going to kill you, because the U.S. will not leave injured soldiers in the battlefield. We're going to go send guys to get them, period. That's the way it works. So they'd shoot somebody in the leg. I'm sitting there. I'm bleeding. Soldiers, medics would have to come out, and they'd have to get them, and they'd shoot them. So it was a very effective way to kind of decrease our troop strength and kind of make us less effective for fighting. These vehicles attempt to sort of provide a concept to the user that, okay, we can do this with one medic that maybe can hide behind a tree or a rock or in a building and still get these guys off the battlefield, which is our doctrine, without endangering more lives, which is very important. Now, the downside of this kind of mechanism where the litter goes into the bay is when that bay door closes, it looks a lot like a coffin from the inside. And the medical guys didn't like that very much at all. So we're still working on that. Similar idea with two robots where two PackBots have chem biosensors on them, and a larger robot takes them out to the battlefield, really this is civilian first response, takes them to 9/11, launches them out, and they provide feedback about basically the environment, if there's contaminants in the environment, things like that. The larger vehicle, which you'll see in a minute if you look carefully, has a, we call it the patient picker-upper. It had a conveyor belt on the back where you'd wedge up the people that are injured, the conveyor belt will turn, suck them on, and you lift them up and extract them out. Again, that's sort of, no, that, not sort of, that is a far-fetched idea, but the whole idea here is, right now, if I have to go out there, I got to put on the bunny suit, which takes lots of time, it's very uncomfortable, I have to go out there, look around, get people, and I can't just come back and take off the suit and start work again, I got to get decontaminated and all that stuff. So using robots to do that's a very, very important thing to try and do. So that was some of the early work we did. Where am I here? So we continue to grow. I think at this point we had 5 people, something like that. And we recognized that, okay, there's a lot of mouths to feed now. What are we going to do? Well, we were very fortunate that we had very smart people at our company, Applied Perception. We won a DARPA Logger program, which was sort of our first real BAA sort of program we won. And the cooler thing about it was Boeing Phantom Works was our sub, so we get to like tell them what to do, which was really cool. Because it usually doesn't, trust me, it never works that way when you're a small company. Another important thing happened was that the TTC, the Technology Collaborative, formed that year as a combination of the NCDR and the Pittsburgh Digital Greenhouse. And on the company side, that gave folks like myself, who are technology guys at heart, access to people that knew not necessarily robotics business, but they knew business. They were business guys with that kind of background. And they told us, you know, you could ask them things and they could provide you a different perspective that, that none of us in this room would have. And that was very valuable for me in learning how to grow this company. Let's see. Move on to 2005. Once again, we moved to bigger offices. Very cool. I like that. That's good. We had 6,000 square feet then. That's where we're at now, half high bay, half office space. Had 10 people working for us, and finally we had managed to break away from having just a bunch of smart PhDs typing code on Emacs or VI and having other people that we had to manage. Imagine that, manage to do something, tell them what to do, meet deliverables of programs, talk to sponsors, all that kind of stuff. So we were turning into a real company. And then the big technical thing was that we won a program with Northrop Grumman called FireE. And the reason it's important is I had always been telling people, we're a robotic software company. We build software for robots. That's what we do. For that program, we actually were selected by Northrop Grumman to provide the software to make their vehicle smart, to let it drive up to 20 kilometers per hour with a tolerance of 8 inches on each side of the 6.5 foot wide vehicle and avoid gross obstacles 24/7, 365 days a year, which, believe it or not, it took us a long time to, I mean, that's incredibly difficult, but the government literally said things like, well, if there's a baby laying on the road, are you going to see it and how are you going to stop? And we spent a lot of time saying, look, there's no way we can do that sort of stuff. You know, if you set us up to do that, we're going to fail, and you don't want that. So we spent a lot of time talking to our customer, I guess trying to manage expectations, and that's one of the things that, that had to learn how to do, because if we would have done that, we would have not been successful. And as a company, our reputation as being the software guys would have been sort of hosed, basically. The vehicle is very cool. It's a variant of the vehicle with the red cross on it. 6,000 pounds. It has RTK, GPS. It has the ubiquitous SICK laser on the front. It had 6 millimeter wave radars ringing it. The radar and the laser in front were fused together to provide gross object detection. These bottles are eight feet apart, and the vehicle is, what did I say? Maybe they're 7 feet, and the vehicle's 6 feet, 6.5 feet. And every time we had to show it could go through those over and over and over without hitting it. Yeah, we didn't have human use review on this either. But also had to stop for gross obstacles. And, you know, we're not operating, we didn't need to operate in cluttered environments, but things like telephone poles, a person standing there, a garbage barrel, a car, were the sorts of things that we had to figure out how to detect and stop for. In 2006, moving forward, the RPR program won the Tibbetts Award for the and the Army SBR Quality Award basis, and these SBRs were the best programs in the military and in the government. And that was cool for me, and you'll notice this is sort of the metamorphosis. That was cool for me not because it justified any technology we'd done, but I immediately thought, you know what, this is a check mark on the list of things that people are going to look for in our company that they want to acquire us or we want to sell. It's going to say, these guys are credible, they've been judged by independent people, in fact, the largest organization in the world, the U.S. government, that what they're doing is good stuff. And honestly, if we buy them, they won't embarrass us. Nothing to do with technology. And that was a very big step for us to win those. We had 15-plus people, and we hired a government affairs person. So can anyone tell me what a government affairs person is?
Lobbyist.
Pork. Turns out in DOD world, you kind of need to have those things. And we hired a lobbyist, which to me was so slimy. It was the slimiest thing to do. But we hired a lobbyist. And, that, and again, that's sort of this corporate growth thing that's going on. A big thing personally for me and for Dean was at that point, assists were still going on during this whole period. They're selling systems, 200, 300 systems out there. At that point, though, we sold AssistWare for $5 million to Cognex. And that's a lot of money, and it's a very big deal. We had no equity outside venture capital. People told us the whole time, you know what, you guys are just doing this company, this lifestyle company, right? That's what you'll hear. If you don't go to Tepper, Tepper guys will say, oh, you guys are doing lifestyle companies. Come to me when you have a real company. Well, we did that, and basically I love my lifestyle. It's great. Also, what that did was that gave me credibility when I wanted to sell API that I know this guy, all right, he must know something, right? He's not a complete idiot. I can count on him. He's a good guy to work for. Sold it to Cognex, who, anyone know who Cognex is? Few. Okay, Cognex is the world's largest machine vision inspection company. And this is another interesting thing on the business side to think about. They didn't buy AssistWare because of great technology. I don't really think they bought AssistWare because they thought the market for lane departure and drowsy driver warning systems was great. They bought AssistWare because they're a public company and their board said you need to diversify because they were going through a downturn. Now, that worked out great for us, but that's the sort of thing that when you're running these companies, you kind of got to get your head around how do you take advantage of those situations. And while make the judgment that maybe while their reason isn't the best reason, it's a good enough reason for you to make a decision to do what we did. And it turned out, both for Dean and myself, that was a great deal. Dean is maybe coming back to CMU looking for a job here in 4 months because his retention agreement's ending. But that allowed us to basically have an exit strategy for this company that was very profitable. It basically allowed the technology to have, you know, a massive amount of funding from a public company to take it to market, sort of, if they chose to do so. And it was a good kind of tying up the technology in a bow and going forward. That was in May of 2007. At that point, basically, I said, all right, I'm betting the farm on API. And I bought Dean out. So I now had all this risk in API. It's like, OK, Todd, this better frickin' work. Or you just made a huge mistake. Fortunately, literally 6 months later, Foster Miller, who I'll talk a little bit more about later, did a kind of a countrywide tour of robotics companies to buy. And they came to Pittsburgh and talked to a couple companies. And, you know, met with them, thought it was great, thought it was a good fit, but didn't hear anything from them. And in November, the guy calls back and says, hey, we're interested in making an investment in you. And I'm like, OK, that's good. So I met with the guy, and their initial plan, what they wanted to do, was to take a 25% stake in the company so we could still do SBIRs and help, that's a key word, help us grow so that we would be big enough essentially to warrant them putting the time in to buy us. And they did the same thing to Automatica. We're very similar companies, just different technologies, different, same scale. They said, look, we want to invest in you guys. You're going to have to invest some of the money we give you. You can take some of it out, but we're going to have this 25% ownership. And, you know, at first blush, it's like, okay, cool. Foster Mills is the largest supplier of robots to the DoD. But then you think about it, it's like, you know, if we're teaming with Foster Miller, it's pretty clear that anyone that wants to get in the robotics business, they're not going to team with us anymore. So that means no Northrops, you know, no GDs, no Lockheed, no iRobot, no SAIC. So essentially, independently say, you know what? No. You got to convince your people that it's all or nothing. You know, go into this all or nothing. And fortunately for us, over the course of the winter, we negotiated a deal to sell API to Foster Miller for $9.2 million and essentially become Foster Miller's software house, put our software on their robots to make their robots smart. And obviously that was a, for me, you know, if I never do anything else in business, that was sort of the capstone event. I don't need to do any more. I can check that box off my goals of life. It was a great thing to do. The other thing that was really cool was NavLab 5, which is this robot we drove across the country, Dean and I drove across the country, we got notified. It was the first CMU robot to be inducted into the Robotics Hall of Fame, or the CMU Robot Hall of Fame. And that was sort of, I don't know, very lucky that those two things happened in the course of 2 months, and sort of the technical side, that was sort of recognized, and on the business side, the same thing. We're here and beyond. Right now, I have to work for Foster Miller for another 15 months and 23 days. talk a little bit more about that later. That's typical in these kind of deals. And we're trying to grow the business. Talk a little bit more about that as well. But sort of, I don't know, this is my life here in Pittsburgh. And over here, I said, you know, we're out of here. I'm going back to Indianapolis. I'm going to work for Delphi and Kokomo and have this life happily ever after. And here, my wife and I would never leave Pittsburgh. We encourage people to come here. It's just been a great place to live, and you know, we wouldn't trade it for the world. How much time do I have, Matt? 15 more minutes? Or am I done?
Yeah,
okay. Okay, so now that's the sappy part's over. Now, what's applied perception? And where do we fit? So, when I was doing this, I thought, okay, how am I going to relate to these guys, this big corporate 15,000 person monolith? So I decided we needed an analogy. And the analogy, as you can read carefully this and the arrow, the analogy I thought we would use is the CMU org chart. Okay? So, the very top we have Kinetic. Kinetic is a UK company that the president of it is like Lord Graham Chisholm. Like, the, I don't know, the Queen did the arrow, the sword thing, and he's really important. So he's sort of equivalent to President Cohen. And I apologize in advance, the website cuts their head off, so their heads are cut off. Under Kinetic is Kinetic North America. The UK is very small, there's not much money to be made there, it's a public company, so they came to America. Kinetic North America is sort of, this is Mark Camelin, is that right? This picture, okay, sort of like, he's provost, okay. Sort of like he's the herder of the academic cats. These guys are the herder of the people that make money. So below them, Randy Bryant, right? Dean of SCS, equivalent to Foster Miller. Now Foster Miller is one of five other companies that Kinetic North America owns. About 354 people in Foster Miller, boatloads in here, but we're the most profitable, make all the money, so they like us the best. That's good. Under Foster Miller is Applied Perception, and that's like Matt. Okay, this is our little robotics thing going on here. Now, under API is me. I'm here. Over here, I would call this your thesis advisor, and I put Chuck's picture up here because he was my thesis advisor. And then there was me as the lowly graduate student in the mud. Now, I thought, you know, this is really cool, but then I looked at it and I thought, in 17 years, I've went up one level of this chart. Like, okay. So, keeps you humble. All right, seriously. We were founded in 2001. We do software. That's all we do. You come to our lab, you see hardware anywhere, but we do software to make robots smart. I'd like to say that we have the largest concentration, corporate concentration of Robotics Institute PhDs and MSs working in UGV applications outside of CMU. Sorry, lots of caveats, I know, but it's a good line. And we put our software in everything from 40-pound pack bots to 6,000-pound tags robots. 22 staff members, 22 engineers. Everyone's an engineer by training there. Foster Miller Pittsburgh, which includes us and Automatica, now has 39 full-time employees, up from 25 8 months ago. So we're growing. We're growing rapidly, and we'd like to have all you be part of it. We have a mandate to have 100 people in the Pittsburgh organization under one roof within 5 years. So 8 months in, we're making good progress to that. Talked about the software. You can see what we do now. Anyone does perception, come see me. Planning, come see me. We've got opportunities in all these areas, and it's also an environment that I think you'll find colleagues in like yourself. Skip the rest of that. All kinds of robots. Basically ranging from, you guys know what Segways, of course. Segway robots that balance themselves, gators, ATVs. You saw the big 6,000-pound robots. This is actually a robotic bomb disposal vehicle. You teleoperate it out, an arm picks up a bomb, throws it inside, and it blows up inside the chamber. Hopefully. All kinds of customers. I think if you look closely enough, like all the major prime contractors are on here. We're working with CMU and Howie right now. Other Pittsburgh companies like ChemImage, worked with DARPA, GD, TARDEC, the Army. Okay, so Foster Mill has this vision. And their vision is to have a robot in every class of DoD and civilian/security applications. Ranges from small ones like Dragon Runner, this is Automatica Hoggins company, builds Dragon Runner, through their Talon. There are 1,500 Talons at least now deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan for basically defusing the roadside bombs that you see blowing up our guys all the time. They're 100% used for that. A Mars robot, basically a larger platform that's for infantry applications, so you don't have to send your kid in first, this will go in first. And then very large vehicles like the TAGs, which I showed you, as well as operator control units. Talon comes in all varieties. There are some on the top row, in particular for SWAT applications. There's firefighter applications. This is a digger, like digging up IEDs. I think this is some hazmat type stuff where you can go out and sniff around before you send first responders in. So lots of payloads you can deploy, professional organization behind them. Every one of these, in fact, every robot you'll see that's smaller is teleoperated. They're not smart. It's basically a $150,000 RC car is what it is. And that's what our job is, to make those smart. Dragon Runner, much smaller, things like for recon, a six-wheeled version. Very cool in that it's backpack transportable. You throw a backpack on, put the Dragon Runner in, you're ready to go. TAGS family, the fiery vehicle you may recognize from the MUD video and the patient recovery one and then the general one. And again, that's very, very big. And it's interesting. You'd think you could teleoperate any size vehicle, but it turns out the bigger the vehicle gets, you almost have to start putting autonomy on it, because you can't provide the operator with the situational awareness of what's around them and what they're doing on a large vehicle very well. So one of the challenges is probably the first one of these that's sold is going to have some form of autonomy, be it waypoint following or some basic obstacle detection, or at least some way to protect the driver from running into stuff, because it's very hard to tell where you are in driving those. And that's a very exciting kind of thing to think about. Mars family, essentially, it's designed to have weapons put on it, to go in to be the point man so the 18-year-old kid doesn't have to break the door down. Also, you can put on like smoke and grenades, and then you can put on really big arms if you need to like pull the door off a car or something. Okay, last set of videos that I want to show, and I'll show some of the simulations that we're working on now. Notice the improvement in quality when Foster Miller does it. So I should have said it before. It's a convoy operation where they've mined the road, and we want to detonate it so the trucks don't run over and get blown up. But you guys probably got that. That's the future of the DoD robotics. That's where we're going. A lot of work to get there. So some actual robots we're doing, is how do you make these little guys smart so the EOD operator can get to the EOD quicker? Essentially, sick like this, you guys could all do what I'm showing here, right? This isn't rocket science. Fusing laser, radar, stereo, flash LiDAR data to avoid obstacles. And I think in this case, the guy is actually driving it, teleoperating it, and the sensors on board are basically modulating his inputs to go around these obstacles. Because as I said, oftentimes you don't have very good situational awareness from the little camera on the arm or something. And the thing is, this will be the sort of technology that will actually be put into production next. It's not going to be that video I showed you. It's the simple stuff. How do you make it easier and safer for the operator to get their job done and quicker? Because every second they're doing this, I mean, the reality is they don't have their finger on the trigger watching for people trying to shoot them. And that's the war we're in now. That's what they're doing to us. Let's see. Okay. All right. Start this up again. This guy, wrong one, but this is the Segway robot. Basically using an Omnicam mounted on the top and a laser rangefinder to follow the person. The important thing to think about here is we've essentially taken the hard part, which is obstacle detection. It's the hardest thing to do in robotics, in my opinion, and offloaded to this guy, because these guys aren't just following him, they're following his footfalls. So it's a lot easier to tell the 18-year-old kid, hey, you know, take a flat route, don't hop over logs, don't go through the ravine, than it is to have a sensor on board to do those same things. Same technology, just showing, and an important thing is that you could almost keep pace with a soldier. You know, if I'm walking like this, that's not very good. If you're in a battlefield area, you need to be able to keep up with the jog, and the robot essentially is able to follow them. The reason we chose Segway is because it has a human sort of form factor in terms of its space, its width. That project, I believe, which was convoying, led to the... I screwed it up. All right. I'm going to have to skip that. So, this last video, I debated if I was going to put it in here or not, but I decided to go ahead and do it, and some of you may have a problem with it, and that's fine, I respect that, but I'm going to tell you my personal story on that, and it's basically applications of weaponized robots and how they could be used. So a couple things about that. 4 months ago, 5 months ago at NRAC, there was a demonstration by, I think, people that are against exactly what you saw. So, and that's fine. I think that's a policy decision, not a robotics decision. And my take on that sort of thing is, I don't know, how many people in here have kids? So I have three kids. I have a 10-year-old boy, an 8-year-old boy, and a 5-year-old boy. And, you know, at first, you're kind of getting through this ethical thing, right? You know, the robot's not firing by itself, but still, there's no danger of the guy sitting in that truck, obviously. And I'm thinking, all right, well, how does that work out? Well, as a dad, in 15 years, this is going to be reality, and my kid is going to be the kid that could be in the military doing that. And the decision I came to wasn't a political one, but the decision was, do I want something like that out there doing that, or do I want my kid stopping that truck, or do I want my kid going through the door? And for me, the decision was pretty easy. So, you know, I'm not trying to shape your opinions of things, but, you know, as you all consider what you're going to do next, you know, even if you decide to do DoD type robotics, and even if you come work for Foster Miller, a company that does this stuff, there's definitely the opportunity to turn things around like this and make, you know, make good things happen out of them. So that's my one kind of moral thing for today, Matt. That's probably illegal too. Sorry. All right, I'm at the end. The best 6 letters of the alphabet, CMU, PhD. Those 6 letters have opened more doors for me than people I knew, than any paper I ever wrote or any software I ever wrote. You guys don't know yet, but you'll know that when you leave here, people will see those letters and immediately, I do this, say, all right, well, he went to CMU. You know, we don't have to worry about asking him this question on the interview. Or, yeah, you know, he had a 3.2, and this kid from MIT had a 3.6, but he's from CMU, so we're going to take him. That kind of stuff. You know, keep that in mind as you guys decide what you're going to do. It's the greatest thing that ever happened to me were those 6 letters. There's no such thing as a robotics company. So I've had 2 companies that ostensibly do robotics, but really what there are markets for robotics-related technologies. One of them was transportation, lane departure warning. One of them was keeping soldiers out of harm's way in the DoD world. One thing I learned during that internet time bubble was building a company takes time. I mean, all of us have seen companies go public for billions of dollars in 2 years, and that's not reality, all right? That's not the reality of the world. It takes time. It took me 6 years to graduate when I came to CMU. It took me a year to learn how to use email. No, just kidding. It took, depending on how you count, either 11 years or 7 years from when we did it full time to sell Assistware. And it took over 5 years for API to get to the point where it can sell. And, you know, these were not huge companies in terms of revenue, but we had a good thing and we pushed on it. And obviously I believe it's worth it. Parting shot, we want you. Now the last one is the most important slide in the talk. And this is something that everyone here is learning now. Basically, you got to trust yourself. You know, if you guys in the back of the room, if you guys want to go out and you want to have an academic career, believe them, that's what it's going to take. If you want to go into industry and work for someone, find the thing you love and do it. If you want to start a company, it will be the scariest thing you've ever done in your life because basically you have no background in business, just like me. Is anyone here from Tepper? Thank God. All right. You're not from Goldman Sachs, driving your BMW 3 Series, parking over in the Tepper parking lot, knowing you can go back to $150,000 a year job, right? But if you believe you want to do it, you know, go for it while you're still young. And you know what? If it doesn't work out, fine. You've tried it and you'll be satisfied. Second most important thing, particularly to everyone in this room, including me, make sure you listen. Trust me. I work with a bunch of engineers. They all think they're right all the time. But there's a lot of people, particularly in the front of the room, that can tell you guys in the back of the room how to make it through this place and in kind of life and in business, whatever, quicker. And you got to make sure you listen to them and then adapt what they've said to your particular situation. That's all. I'm happy to take questions, talk to you all anymore. And again, thank you, Matt, for having me. Any questions? John, did you have a question?
Yeah, so okay. Todd, because this is kind of about your life, what's happening after 15 months and 23 days?
That's a very good question. So honestly, I told Matt this, or I think I told you, I want to take 6 months off and do nothing. You know, I talked about how when you have people work for you, there's this responsibility, there's stress associated with that, and I'm ready to do nothing. I want to get up, I want to get up in the morning in my PJs. I want to go work out, not at 6:30, but at 9:30 in the morning, a reasonable hour. You know, come home. I was going to say watch Oprah, but I'm not going to do that. Do nothing. Pick the kids up from school, coach them in sports, and sort of recharge and figure out, you know, what's next. After that, you know, this criteria. I want to do technology. Not going to invest any of my own money in technology. I'm not going to travel a lot for business because I've missed a lot. And there was one other thing. But that's what I'm going to do next.
You really think you could do nothing for 6 months?
I'm going to try.
Why don't you get a pool? I've taken 1 week.
How much?
Questions? Other questions?
Oh, great. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Thanks, sir. I enjoyed it. May, how are you?